This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 24th, 2011. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, in for Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the influential lobbying group, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is holding its annual meeting in Washington, D.C. We'll look at what's being done to resolve the murders of journalists in the Philippines and in the Bay Area.
That this is a noble profession, and that somebody needs the eye-opener to be able to achieve justice, to continue the profession.
And indigenous townspeople displaced by a conflict in rural Mexico attempt to return home. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert with these headlines. Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad has suffered a serious heart attack. The Associated Press says he was visiting Austin, Texas to attend his son's college graduation when he was hospitalized with chest pains. Doctors say he should be discharged within 2 days. Fayyad is a political independent who was appointed after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas fired a Hamas-nominated prime minister. It's unclear whether Fayyad will keep his job in the wake of the recent reconciliation between Hamas and Abbas's Fatah party. Meanwhile, the Israeli prime minister spoke on Capitol Hill today, rejecting calls for Israel to return to its 1967 borders and refusing to negotiate with any Palestinian government that includes Hamas. Alice Olstein has more from Washington.
Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister of Israel.
Applause from representatives and senators welcomed Prime Minister Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress this morning and to share his ideas for peace in the Middle East.
I stood before my people and I said, I will accept a Palestinian state. It's time for President Abbas to stand before his people and say, I will accept a Jewish state. Those six words will change history.
Netanyahu blamed Palestinians for the failure to achieve peace in the region. He criticized the Palestinian Authority for collaborating with Hamas and trying to win recognition from the United Nations. Protesters in the gallery interrupted Netanyahu's address, and members of Congress cheered as they were removed. The prime minister's week in Washington included a meeting with President Obama, a talk with Jewish Democrats and Republicans in Congress, and a keynote address to AIPAC's annual policy conference. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And an update on that story. The protester who interrupted Netanyahu's speech has reportedly been hospitalized. She was with the organization Code Pink Women for Peace. We'll have more on this week's AIPAC summit and U.S.-Israeli foreign policy later in this newscast. Egypt's public prosecutor has referred former President Hosni Mubarak to stand trial for allegedly ordering security forces to kill anti-government protesters during the uprising that toppled his government. This just 2 days after an Egyptian court imposed the death sentence on a police officer convicted of killing 20 demonstrators during the uprising. The prosecutor says he will also bring Mubarak's 2 sons to trial as well. The body of former Chilean President Salvador Allende has been exhumed from his family mausoleum. Allende was the first socialist president elected in the Western Hemisphere. His government was overthrown in a military coup that ushered in the 17-year dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
A Santiago appeals court judge ordered Allende's body exhumed after a request by the former president's family. An international forensic team will now try to determine what caused President Allende's death. In the more than 3 decades that followed his overthrow, the official story has been that Allende committed suicide as Chilean army forces stormed the presidential palace during Augusto Pinochet's coup. The Allende family issued a statement saying they welcomed the investigation. The family also provided DNA samples so investigators can ensure the body in Allende's coffin is indeed that of the former president. It will take about a week to produce an autopsy report. There are also calls in Chile to investigate the death of Nobel laureate Pablo Neruda, a strong Allende supporter who died 12 days after the coup. Jorge Garretón, FSRN, Santiago.
The Japanese utility responsible for the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan has admitted the accident there was much worse than previously disclosed. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, now concedes that fuel rods in its Unit 2 and 3 reactors suffered near-total meltdown soon after the March earthquake. The utility didn't admit until last week that its Unit 1 reactor, the site of the plant's worst accident, had suffered a meltdown at all. Today's disclosures bring the number of confirmed meltdowns at Fukushima to 3. There are now 117 confirmed deaths and over 600 confirmed injuries from the massive tornado that ripped through Joplin, Missouri on Sunday. The region is bracing for more twisters tonight. The Storm Prediction Center of the National Weather Service says there's a high risk of severe weather and tornadoes in Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, Arkansas, and Missouri. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca. A series of NATO airstrikes targeted the Libyan capital, Tripoli, today in what some describe as the heaviest bombardment yet in the offensive to remove Muammar Gaddafi from power. A government spokesperson said three were killed and dozens injured. The airstrikes come as the Obama administration missed a deadline on Friday to get approval from Congress to continue the war in Libya. However, a bipartisan group of senators introduced a resolution Monday supporting that continuation, according to the online news outlet Politico. The conflict in Libya has created a massive refugee crisis, with thousands fleeing to Tunisia. Some of the camps along the border are now seeing tensions and violence. FSRN's reporter Marine Olivesi is in Tunisia. She just returned from Chucha camp and joins us on the line. What exactly happened?
So we stayed about half a mile away from the camp. We couldn't drive closer because of roadblocks organized by locals. And we quickly had to turn around, actually, because some of these locals went after us. They smashed the windshield of our car, and so we had to leave. These locals are Tunisian men in their 20s going around in pickups. Right next to us, we saw some of them, some of these locals chasing with sticks and bats a group of about 60 sub-Saharan migrants, about 60 migrants from sub-Sahara, like they were cattle, and migrants were running away from them.
How did this clash between refugees and locals start?
So to understand how it started, we have to go back to Saturday night. A fire broke out at the camp on Saturday morning at about 3 a.m. Four Eritrean men died in the fire. All were asylum seekers registered with UNHCR. And following that accident, there's been ongoing demonstrations by refugees. They were mostly protesting against the living conditions at the camp. Most of them have been at the camp for over 2 months now. They've been really anxious to hear about when and where they will be resettled. So that fire accident was just the stroke that broke the camel's back, if you can say. As a sign of protest, they blocked the main cross-border road yesterday and then again today. The problem is that road is vital to the economy of the small border town of Ben Garden. And locals in Ben Garden decided to organize themselves to take, since the police didn't seem to do much, they decided to organize themselves and break the roadblock set by refugees. And that's when things started to get sort of out of control. And that was this morning, late in the morning, early in the afternoon.
How were international organizations on the ground, like the UNHCR, the United Nations agency that is managing the camp, how are they handling this situation?
So there are about 16 people from UNHCR. 16 people from UNHCR were taken hostage yesterday, or at least trapped in the demonstrations for 4 hours. Trapped by the refugees that were protesting at Shusha camp. So they decided, because of the situation, not to go today. So no international organization, no humanitarian staff was on the ground today, which sort of left refugees on their own against locals. At that point, some officials have been saying that the situation has really gone beyond the UNHCR head. Now it's really up to the Tunisian military and up to the Tunisian authorities to reestablish order. There's not much UNHCR can do by itself.
Finally, what's the role of the Tunisian army in this?
And regarding the role of the Tunisian army, I mean, UNHCR was announcing this morning a military intervention, and there's been reports of the military throwing tear gas and firing in the air to disperse the crowds. what I've heard, I just heard from a refugee who said that indeed 50 to 60 Tunisian soldiers have finally taken control of the situation and scared away the bandits, the Tunisian bandits. But refugees on the phone all day were saying some of they could see the military in the camp, but the military wasn't doing anything to protect them. And apparently all day long, the locals have been setting fire on some tents at the camp. They've been stealing from the refugees' tents and taking away refugees' belongings. And the Tunisian military, from what refugees told us, the Tunisian military let them, when they dispersed the crowd about half an hour or an hour ago, they let the crowd take everything they had stolen with them, which some refugees are really mad about. So the latest news is that the Tunisian army seems to have retaken the control of the camp and cracked down on those local bandits. It scared them off, but the situation is still very fluid. We've heard of some groups of refugees actually marching through the desert, marching back towards the border, trying to escape that crisis situation, that riot situation going on at the camp.
That was reporter Marine Olivesi on the line from Tunisia. You are listening to FSRN. In the Philippines, family members of those killed during the Ampatuan massacre say they are still seeking justice a year and a half later. 58 were killed, 32 of whom were journalists and media workers. But less than half of the nearly 200 suspects have been arrested, much less arraigned. Madonna Vivrola reports from Quezon City.
Journalists, lawmakers, and concerned citizens gathered this week to commemorate those killed in November 23, 2009 in the southern Philippine province of Maguindanao. Editha Tiamzon's husband, Daniel, a crew member for UNTV, was one of those killed that day.
The case has been very slow. Like the other widows, I am experiencing depression.
A year and a half ago, 58 people traveling in a convoy to file gubernatorial candidacy papers for Ismael Mangadadato were brutally killed. Many were dragged to a nearby hill where they were shot or hacked to death with knives, then buried, some of them alive, in shallow graves. The attackers shot most of the women in the genitals, according to investigators, and some showed evidence of rape. Those killed included Mangadadato's wife, pregnant sister, and aunt. Mangadadato was running against Andal Ampatuan Jr. in the Maguindanao governor's race to replace the patriarch of the family, Andal Ampatuan Sr. Philippine authorities charged Ampatuan Jr. with murder shortly after the massacre, and he has been jailed while on trial. Sonny Fernandez is director of the National Union of Journalists in the Philippines, or NUJP, which has been assisting the families and relatives of the slain journalists and media workers.
There's only one hearing that is ongoing with the primary suspect, Andal Ampatuan Jr. Out of the 196 suspects, only 90 plus were arrested. 57 remain to be arraigned. A lot of motions have been filed, over nearly 100, mostly by the defense. And many of these motions do not have much substance, we believe. It's just a dilatory tactic on their part.
The Ampatuan family is very powerful, and Fernandez says their wealth, which remains unfrozen, is being used to weaken the case of the prosecution. The Journalists' Union has also condemned the contempt charges filed by the Court of Appeals against their Secretary General Rowena Paraan and Monet Salaysay, a widow of one of the victims, after they publicly criticized two of the judges reviewing suspects' petitions to have their murder charges thrown out.
These people are just expressing their feelings. It's a right of any Filipino citizen in the country to air their grievances against the government.
Some credit officials for strengthening the witness protection program and freeing the judge on the Ampatuan case from handling other cases, increasing the frequency of hearings from once a week into twice a week. But Professor Luis Teodoro, deputy director of the Center for Media Freedom and Responsibility, is not impressed. He points to continued attacks on journalists.
Despite the promises of the new government, very little has actually been done. For example, the new government committed itself about last August 2010 to creating rapid response teams or to send to places where journalists have been killed. But as we have seen, from May 2010 to May 2011, 9 journalists have been killed in the Philippines.
On Monday, the National Union of Journalists in the Philippines mounted a roving photo exhibit dubbed Never Forget the Ampatuan Massacre at the House of Representatives in Quezon City. Among others, the photos show mutilated bodies covered with banana leaves. Jun Sepe is president of the Philippine Center for Photojournalism. He hopes the exhibit will educate the country, especially the youth, and teach them about the journalists who lost their lives and the risks they took.
We're not scaring them. In fact, we want them to follow our footsteps. That this is a noble profession, and that somebody need the eye-opener for to be able to achieve justice, to continue the profession.
At the end of the commemoration program, supporters clad in black t-shirts lit candles in memory of those who died. Widow Editha Tiamzon is among them.
Sa ngayon, unite pa naman kami. Talagang inaano namin yung laban namin na makamit namin talaga yung hustisya sa kasong ito at maipaglaban namin.
We, the victims' families, are not losing hope because we have supporters like other journalists who have united and people in Congress. We believe justice is on our side, like if the questionable wealth of the perpetrators would be frozen so there cannot be bribery.
Pasalamat ako dito sa Congress at naipasok ito dito sa exhibit na ito na maipakita sa kanila na porsigido kami at porsigido ang mga kasamang asosasyon at yung...
In her speech, Tiamzon refused to elaborate, saying she does not want to be faced with contempt charges. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Quezon City, Philippines.
Families displaced by violence in the Mexican town of San Juan Copala are attempting to return to the homes they fled last year. The rural town in the southern state of Oaxaca declared itself autonomous in January of 2007, but differences among factions in the region led to what many call a paramilitary siege, which lasted for 10 months. In the early months of the siege, armed men blocked vehicular access to and from San Juan Copala and fired shots from the hills that overlook the town. As the situation intensified, snipers targeted the families of those who supported the autonomy project, often wounding people who left their homes or who attempted to flee the town on foot. By mid-October 2010, more than a dozen of the small town's residents were dead, and many others had been wounded by gunfire. Some residents who escaped the conflict fled to Oaxaca City, where they set up a protest camp in front of the government palace. Women here swept the sidewalk this morning ahead of their departure for Mexico City as part of a caravan. Reina Martinez Flores is the spokesperson for the Oaxaca City camp and is herself displaced by the conflict.
Esta marcha más que nada es por todos los muertos que hemos...
She says the purpose of the caravan is to demand justice for those who were killed and to gather up the displaced in order to return to the town. Two caravans of observers attempted to reach San Juan Copala last year. Armed men fired upon the first one, killing a prominent Mexican human rights activist and a Finnish observer. The second caravan was prevented from advancing to the town by a convoy of state police. I asked Reina Martinez Flores if the state government of Oaxaca had given assurances that the caravan would be able to reach the town this time.
We haven't received any guarantees, and we're well aware of this. But the thing is that we've been here for a long time already, and the people want to go back to their town, to their homes. The government has been stringing us along and has even told us that we should wait until there are conditions for our return. But the people are fed up, desperate in the sense that they no longer want to wait until the government decides when it's time to go back to San Juan Copala. The displaced persons are the ones who took this decision, and we're going to respect it.
those who fled San Juan Copala either sought refuge in the indigenous Triqui region or have been living in the camps that were established last August in the state capital and in Mexico City. Martinez Flores told FSRN that a group of women will remain behind in the Oaxaca City camp in the event that the displaced are unable to return to their town.
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard them say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved them wrong. Twitter has them paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized, organized.
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Yalla. El hip hop el Masri.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project. Arab Hip Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring.
The influential lobbying group, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is holding its annual meeting in Washington, D.C. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed Congress today, celebrating the two countries' historically close relations. Prior to his departure for Europe, President Obama reaffirmed the United States' support for the Israeli government during a speech on Sunday. But one aspect of U.S. support to Israel has been sensitive, that of military aid. Michael Lawson has more.
According to the Congressional Research Service, Israel is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign assistance since World War II. The U.S. has given Israel $3 billion a year since 1985. In 2008, Congress affirmed U.S. policy that maintains aid to give Israel a, quote, qualitative military edge over others, and President Obama has asked for an increase of $75 million in aid to Israel in his fiscal year 2012 budget. Addressing AIPAC Sunday, President Obama reiterated this support.
Because we understand the challenges Israel faces, I and my administration have made the security of Israel a priority. It's why we've increased cooperation between our militaries to unprecedented levels.
But anti-war and progressive analysts have long questioned the amount of military aid given to Israel. Allison Ware is president of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. She says figures from the IMF place Israel within the top 50 wealthiest countries by GDP. Ware says in a time of economic sacrifice, Americans should be aware of where their tax dollars are going.
It's very important for them to know we have, as American citizens, have a huge financial connection to Israel-Palestine. As soon as they hear that, they start to pay attention. They learn about the amount of tax money that goes that we can't afford, and they also learn about the tragic injustice that Palestinians are enduring.
Israel has a relationship with the U.S. not shared with other countries. In addition to direct aid, Israel has received millions in loan guarantees and economic aid, in addition to access to U.S. military research and development. $800 million worth of U.S. military equipment is stored in Israel for its use in emergency situations. A State Department investigation was launched in 2007 into Israel's possible use of American-produced cluster bombs on civilian targets in fighting with Lebanon, a violation of the export agreement. The investigation found Israelis may have used the cluster munitions, but came to no definite conclusions or consequences. Philip Giraldi is a former CIA officer and executive director of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. He says Israel should be treated like any other country.
So let's have a common sense approach. Let's say Israel is basically like any other country in the world, and when they behave badly, you say it, and when they behave well, you say it. And if you sell them weapons like you do to other countries that are friendly, you have certain caveats and restrictions on how they use it.
The issue of the relationship between Israel, the U.S., and its neighbors is one in which passions run high. Morton Klein is president of the Zionist Organization of America, the oldest pro-Israel organization in the U.S. He says Israel's aid is singled out over other countries unfairly.
Well, you have to ask, what about foreign aid in general? Should we continue to give $1.5 billion to Pakistan? Should we continue to give almost $1 billion a year to the Palestinian Authority, who gets the most amount of foreign aid per capita of any country in the history of the world, when they have now merged with Hamas, terrorist organization whose charter calls for Israel's destruction?
Klein says Israel merely desires survival, and without a strong defense structure aided by the U.S., its surrounding Arab countries would attack. In return, he says, Israel remains a reliable ally to the U.S., and the country uses most of its aid to purchase from U.S. weapons manufacturers. Peace activists and progressive Jewish groups have been protesting the AIPAC gathering. During Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address Monday night, several activists stood up and interrupted the speech. The United States is scheduled to increase its aid to Israel to over $3.1 billion in 2013. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
In California, a jury is deliberating the case of a triple murder in Alameda County involving the death of a journalist. The defendant, Yousef Bey IV, is accused of ordering the killings of Oakland Post editor Chauncey Bailey and two other men. Tina Backerman has more on the final days of the trial.
The trial started in March and included testimony from 60 witnesses. The prosecution presented 175 exhibits of evidence. Defendant Yousef Bey is the former head of Your Black Muslim Bakery. His co-defendant, Antoine Mackey, is also being tried on three counts of murder for allegedly carrying out Bey's order to kill. During closing arguments, the defense focused on the credibility of the prosecution's lead witness, Devondre Broussard, who had previously admitted to killing Oakland Post journalist Chauncey Bailey and agreed to testify for the prosecution in exchange for a reduced sentence. Defense lawyers pointed out that Broussard constantly changed his story and wasn't forced or promised riches to gun down Bailey. In her rebuttal, prosecutor Melissa Crum said neither Broussard nor Antoine Mackey had personal beef against any of the three victims who were murdered in 2007, during the time that Your Black Muslim Bakery was in bankruptcy proceedings, and journalist Bailey had been investigating the company's finances. Outside the courtroom, Chauncey Bailey's brother, Errol Cooley, responded.
It's been a long, long trial, and it's like opening up a can of worms all over again. It's flaring everything back up for the family's sake. She has a lot of good evidence. It'll be just nice when everything is over with. That's kind of like Kobe Bryant playing against somebody in kindergarten, like a slam dunk. The evidence is obvious.
In a surprise move, defendant Antoine Mackey took the witness stand in his own defense in the final days of the trial, characterizing himself as a cashier nerd at the bakery. Prosecutor Crum told the jury that there's no such thing as the demeanor of a killer. To illustrate her point, she showed the jury photos of convicted killer Scott Peterson and serial killer Ted Bundy. Antoine Mackey's defense attorney Gary Sebrew then motioned for a mistrial, saying the photos were inflammatory. Yousef Bey IV didn't testify in the trial. During closing arguments, he sat at the defense table wearing a black bow tie and pinstripe suit. Outside the courtroom, his defense attorney, Gene Peretti, reacted to the prosecution's rebuttal.
I still think that she's got significant problems with Broussard as a witness, and she's going to have to live with that. And hopefully the jury will make a judgment and correct one.
Bey IV and Mackey have pleaded not guilty and face life in prison without the possibility of parole. Tina Boschman, FSRN, Oakland.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young.